Hester's gifts of insight and intelligence were quite extraordinary. Yet counterbalancing these talents was the fact that she did not know quite who she was up against. Take, for instance, John the Dig. His suspicion of her had not escaped her notice, but she was not put off. She was a stranger in the house, and it was up to her to demonstrate that she was there for the good of all and not to cause trouble. In time, she knew she would win him over. Yet though he seemed to get used to her presence, his suspicion was unexpectedly slow to fade. And then one day, suspicion flared into something else. She had approached him over something quite banal. In our garden she had seen, or so she maintained, a child from the village who should have been at school. "Who is the child?" she wanted to know. "Who are its parents?" "Nothing to do with me," John told her with a surliness that took her aback. "I don't say it is," she responded calmly. "But the child should be in school. I'm sure you'll agree with me on that. If you will just tell me who it is, then I will speak to the parents and the schoolmistress about it." John the Dig shrugged his shoulders and made to leave. But she was not a woman who would be put off in this manner. She darted around him, stood in front of him, and repeated her demand. Why should she not? It was an entirely reasonable one, and she was making it in a civil fashion. Whatever reason would the man have to refuse? But refuse he did.
"Children from the village do not come up here," was his only response.
"This one did," she went on. "The child was in a wide-brimmed hat and a man's trousers cut down to fit. His appearance was quite distinctive. You must know who he is."
"I've seen no such child," came the answer dismissively, and once again John made to leave.
Hester was nothing if not persistent. "But you must have seen him."
"It takes a certain kind of mind, miss, to see things that aren't there. Me, I'm a sensible fellow. Where there is nothing to see, I see nothing. If I were you, miss, I would do the same. Good day to you."
Or take, for another instance, her habit of leaving the twins to their own devices for short periods while she followed her own agenda elsewhere. She watched the twins closely first, evaluating their moods, weighing up their fatigue, the closeness to meal times, their patterns of energy and rest. When the results of this analysis told her the twins were set for an hour of quiet indoor lolling, she would leave them unattended. On one of these occasions, she had a special purpose in mind. The doctor had come, and she wanted a particular word with him. A private word. Foolish Hester, there is no privacy where there are children. She met him at the front door.
"It is a nice day. Shall we walk in the garden?"
They set off toward the topiary garden, unaware that they were being followed.
"You have worked a miracle, Miss Barrow," the doctor began. "Emmeline is transformed."
"No," said Hester.
"Yes, I assure you. My expectations have been more than fulfilled. I am very impressed."
Hester bowed her head and turned her body fractionally away from him. Taking her response for modesty, he fell silent, thinking her overwhelmed by his professions of esteem. The neatly clipped yew gave him something to admire while the governess recovered her sang-froid. Her protesting no was far from being the feminine simpering that the doctor took it for. It was a straightforward statement of fact. Of course, Emmeline was transformed. Given the presence of Hester, how could it have been otherwise? There was nothing miraculous about it. That is what she meant by her no. Slowly, they began to walk between the topiary shapes, admiring the yews while speaking of Hester's work. Keeping a safe distance, but always within earshot, a little spy followed them, moving from the protection of one yew to another. Left and right they moved. Sometimes they turned to double back on themselves. It was a game of angles, an elaborate dance.